Lecture 16, Cyrus, Xenophon, and the 10,000.
Welcome back. In the spring of 404 BC, the same year in which Athens fell, the great king far away in Persia died. And there was a question as to who would succeed him. His principal wife, Queen Parysatis, had two sons, an older son named Artaxerxes, and a younger son whom we have already met, that Prince Cyrus, who was sent westward to Asia Minor to be the viceroy there and to bring about the fall of Athens and the return of the Ionian cities to the king's fold through helping Sparta. Prince Cyrus was his mother's favorite, and Parysatis had been feeding him with the notion that in spite of the fact that he was the younger son, he would be king. His sterling qualities as a commander and as a person would ensure that his father would name him. Well, his father did not. And so Prince Cyrus started the new regime with a great feeling of having been hard done by, which continued to be fed by his mother, the queen. He was in the capital there at Susa when his father died, and Artaxerxes, the new king, was suspicious, and quite justifiably so, of Prince Cyrus, his younger brother. So just to get him out of the way, he sent him back to Asia Minor, back to the west, as some sort of viceroy over the satraps there. This was a new arrangement in Persian affairs at that time. But it was simply intended to get his brother out of the scenes of court intrigues and places where he might be able to stage a palace coup. It's not clear what would have happened if Prince Cyrus had been kept at court and integrated into palace life. Perhaps he would have settled down, realized what his place was, and been a good brother to Artaxerxes. But knowing that you're under suspicion is a situation that often impels one to do the very thing that you are suspected of being about to do. Prince Cyrus decided, as he was there in Asia Minor, that he was darn well going to raise his own army, and he was going to march on the heartland of Persia, his brother's kingdom, and seize the throne that he felt was his by right of superior character. Where was he going to get this army? Well, the Greek world was now at peace for the first time in 27 years of fighting this Peloponnesian War. Thousands of men who'd been in the armies on the Athenian side or on the Peloponnesian and Spartan side were now free, fully trained, no place to go. The Greek economy was somewhat depressed by the fall of Athens. Athens had been the great economic engine of Greece. And so Cyrus decided to use his gold to hire an army, the army that came to be known as the 10,000. An army of about 13,000 Greeks, the core of which was 10,000 hoplites, those heavily armed infantry shield men who fought side to side in the phalanx. And there was an additional 3,000 archers, slingshot specialists, javelin throwers, light-armed troops, the people that the Greeks called peltasts because they would pelt the enemy with missiles, not nearly so prestigious as the hoplite warriors. The call went out through the Greek world, through various channels, through agents of the Persians. The Greeks came to know, Greek young men came to hear about this great opportunity. Now, the tradition of being a soldier of fortune, and especially a soldier of fortune in the East, went back hundreds of years. In fact, it's my belief that the Greek hoplite tradition really began because these Greeks learned that they could find fame, glory, and wealth by learning how to fight in the hoplite phalanx and hiring themselves out to these potentates everywhere from Iberia to the Nile. So Cyrus was not really doing something new. But the scale of putting together an army of 10 to 13,000, that's the size of the army of Athens. Not the fleet, but the actual land army of Athens was that same size. And now it's going to be a mercenary army under the leadership of one Persian prince bound for the heartland of Asia. One of the young men who heard about this opportunity, he heard about it from a friend of his in the Greek region of Boeotia, the area where the city of Thebes is, traditional enemies of Athens. This young Athenian who heard about it was named Xenophon. And he was 27 years old at the time, still not a full age in the Athenian system. In Athens, you are able to go into the assembly and start to sit and listen to debates and vote when you're 20, but you must spend the next 10 years listening, learning, and then at 30, you can both make your maiden speech in the assembly, and you can also be elected to a magistrate's post or elected general or something like that. To be elected to some of the posts, like general, you also had to have married and had children, so you had a real stake in the city's future. Xenophon, at 27, was feeling very alienated from his city of Athens. He was, of course, disappointed to be living in a city that had just been defeated, but he hated the democracy. He was born an aristocrat. He was a rider, a horseman. In later life, he wrote the ancient world's greatest book on horsemanship. And he felt, apart from the mass of Athenians, he had associated himself with possibly the greatest Athenian of all time, a teacher named Socrates, a great teacher who had no schoolhouse, but rather could be found in the agora, the open space, under the plane trees planted by Cimon, talking, inquiring, probing, driving people nuts with his endless questions about what did things really mean and what were they doing with their lives. Xenophon was a student of Socrates at the same time that young Plato was a student. Socrates was like that other famous teacher of antiquity, Jesus, who never wrote anything down himself, but his followers couldn't stop writing about him and what he said and what it all meant. And so Xenophon and Plato are for us the two lenses through which we can see back to Socrates and what it was like to be with him there in Athens. But they are very different lenses. They presumably each distort in a slightly different way what the true Socrates was like. Plato was very interested in intellectualism, in ideas and ideals, the whole idea of the world really being about ideal forms that are hidden from us, but which the material world is continually striving to assimilate itself to. That's in Plato, and that's his view of what mattered in Socrates' talk, this idea of the quest for beauty, for virtue, for ideal behavior patterns, and ideal understandings of the moral world. Xenophon remembered Socrates as the most practical person he'd ever met. Practical in the sense of wanting to talk to people about being the best possible soldier you can be, the best general you can be, talking about tactics, talking about approaches to everyday life, using a very humble similes all the time from everyday life. So we get two very different visions of Socrates from Xenophon and from his contemporary and rival. The two obviously didn't get along very well, Plato. Xenophon went to Socrates, his teacher, and told him what he was planning to do. Now, Socrates had been a soldier. Socrates, in fact, was early on a friend of Alcibiades, that notorious Athenian who we met last time. And on the occasion when Alcibiades, as an 18-year-old, enlisted under the famous Athenian tactician and military leader Phormio, who we also talked about last time, Alcibiades and Socrates had gone together under Phormio's command to the north of Greece, had fought in a winter campaign there, had had many adventures. Alcibiades had fought his way through to the enemy position, had fallen from a wound. Socrates had placed himself over Alcibiades' fallen, wounded body and kept the enemy at bay until help could arrive. Socrates was given the prize for, Alcibiades was initially given the prize for valor in that fight, a suit of hoplite armor by the great general Phormio, and Alcibiades promptly gave it to his beloved Socrates as a token of his love and his friendship. It was a wild time, and everybody in Athens was involved in the military. I mean, that was part of the mark of a citizen. So Socrates was no stranger to warfare. And on the other hand, to just because we're going to drift away from Socrates in a moment, I just would like to say, Xenophon puts us in touch with what was perhaps the younger Socrates. Socrates himself said he started off his philosophical life inquiring after things like how far is the sun from the earth and what do you suppose the sun weighs and natural historical questions of what we would consider a scientific nature. And then he decided, partway through his adult life, what am I doing? What does all this matter? It's what's inside people that counts. It's the moral decisions that you make. It's the way you lead your life. It's your thoughts. This is what I should be talking about. Men, not nature. And so he shifted over to the kind of philosopher that we know of from the writings of Plato and a little bit from Xenophon as well. He had therefore become a magnet for young men in Athens who wanted to think deeply about the choices they were making in life. Socrates called that his second voyaging. He said, it's as if you're out on a ship, you've got the sail up to begin with. That's what I was on my first phase of philosophy. I was sailing along with the wind, and then the wind dropped. Well, I ran out the oars, and I went ahead by rowing, and that was my second voyaging, and that's what I'm doing now. It's manpower at the oars. I'm studying people, men, human beings. What can I do to help you see yourself, know yourself, in the Delphic Oracle's terms, and make the right choice? He was very against this idea of Xenophon's, of going off with the Persians. The reason was this. Prince Cyrus was known in Athens to have funded the Spartan drive that finally succeeded in destroying Athens and taking away the Athenian Empire. Prince Cyrus of Persia was the man that Xenophon was planning to go and swear his allegiance to and fight for. Socrates was very concerned that this would result in Xenophon's banishment, exile from Athens, by an angry fellow citizenry who would regard Xenophon then as a traitor. And he didn't want that to happen to this beloved young man. So Xenophon said, well, I'll go to the Delphic Oracle and I'll ask for advice. And he went across the mountains to Mount Parnassus and Delphi. He went into the temple and he went down that long ramp that the Athenian envoys and the Lydian envoys had all gone down before him, into the crypt, into the darkness, asked his question of the woman, but he didn't really remain true to Socrates' hope that he would say, should I go on this expedition? He said instead, if I go on this expedition, which gods should I sacrifice to for success? So he got an answer from Delphi. He went back, told Socrates what he'd done. Socrates was annoyed with him, but gave him his blessing, and off went Xenophon to that city we've been to so often, Sardis, near the western coast of Asia Minor, the capital of the old kingdom of Lydia, where our story began with Croesus, 150 years before Xenophon sets off. Xenophon arrived and found that the leader of this group of mercenaries that Prince Cyrus was putting together was a Spartan, a renegade Spartan, a notorious man named Clearchus, who had been among the Spartan leaders who were put in charge of various cities around what had been the Athenian Empire and which was, at the speed of light, turning into a Spartan Empire. The Persians had not imagined this happening. They still have thought of the Spartans as rather stodgy people who would never spend much time away from home, but they'd reckoned without Lysander, that imperialist, that genius, that strategic mastermind who'd figured out how to catapult Sparta into the same position Athens had held as leaders of the Greeks at large, and also, of course, Lysander, who's denied the possibility of ever being king in Sparta because he's not of the royal line. This is the way that he hopes, as Themistocles once hoped, to be the first man among the first people in Greece, is through this idea of great maritime empire. The people that the Spartans placed as Spartan heads of garrisons in these various cities that they are now ruling, some of which were cities they had promised to give back to the Persians, to the great king, were called harmosts. H-A-R-M-O-S-T is the way we put it in English. And these harmosts got a terrible reputation for brutality, for tyrannical behavior, for harsh treatment of the local populations. Pretty soon the locals were longing for the Athenians to come back, tribute, tax payments, and all, rather than put up with these Spartans. Clearchus in the great city of Byzantium, that's modern Istanbul, it's on the Bosphorus, it's another one of those cities along the grain route that can control the flow of commodities from the Black Sea into the Aegean. Byzantium was an old colony of the little Greek city of Megara long before. There at Byzantium, Clearchus behaved so outrageously that he was stripped of his command by the Spartans and sent off in disgrace. He was then hired very quickly by Cyrus, who needed a tough, hard-as-nail commander to weld together this 10,000 hoplite force from all over the Greek world, many different cities represented there, and lead them after Prince Cyrus, following Prince Cyrus, into the heart of the Persian Empire. So they set out in the spring, we're all the way up to the year 401 BC now, 3 years after the great king's death, 3 years after the accession of Artaxerxes, 3 years after the fall of Athens. On a spring day, they set out from Sardis. The only person in the whole army of the 10,000, as far as we can tell, who really knew where they were going was Clearchus himself. Prince Cyrus had taken this general into his confidence. The rest of the men were told, "We're going a little way eastward to the highland country of Pisidia, and there are some troublesome hill tribes there, and we're going to suppress them and bring them to order." A simple campaign, the pay was good, the distance was not great, and they all trooped off, although any of them who'd sat down to think, why does it take 10,000 Greeks and another, well, the ancient sources said 100,000, it was probably more like 20,000, but tens of thousands more Asian troops to put down a few bandit tribes? But nobody seems to have asked the question until they got into the middle part of Asia Minor, working on the system of royal roads, and went right through Pisidia and out the other side. Well, they got to Cilicia, which lies beyond, and the men staged their first mutiny, their first of many, and said, "We're not going any further till we get full pay for what we've done so far." One of the ways of keeping troops loyal to a cause, or at least keeping them in line and present for duty, was holding up their pay until the campaign was over, so that once they've invested a certain number of days in the effort, they're going to be very unwilling to break ranks and leave. Cyrus was in sore straits here. He'd had enough money for the sort of initial payments that brought everybody in, but he didn't have the money to give them the arrears of pay that they were demanding. And we have to remember, it's not just the soldiers that are Cyrus's headache. They are surrounded by an equally large number of auxiliaries, camp followers. Let's go kind of a little bit down the list of who's marching with them, but invisible most of the time in the ancient historical accounts. There's a wagon train following the army of probably something like 1,500 wheeled carts. There are the drivers for the carts and the grooms for the animals, the pack animals like the mules, and the draft animals like the oxen and mules that are pulling the carts. And remember, the army can't move any faster than the slowest cart. It's like that saying about the caravan moving no faster than the slowest camel. There are all those people. There are armorers and leather workers and weapon makers who are going to make or repair the weaponry of the soldiers. There are doctors who will bind up their wounds. There are women who will accompany these men and attend to their needs. There are bakers to make the daily bread, because the army travels with unground grain. It's been parched. It will last a long time. As soon as you grind it into flour, it's subject to spoilage very quickly. So they can't take along flour ready for mixing, kneading into dough and baking bread every day. There are portable ovens for baking the bread that these bakers are in charge of. There are weavers for making cloth. On and on and on. Carpenters for putting up the temporary forts. Engineers for building the bridges that will span the rivers. Interpreters who will deal with the various people they meet along the way. And finally, in sort of a outer cloud around this city on the move, are the traders. Soldiers are getting loot. One of the things that Cyrus immediately does to kind of keep his 10,000 happy is there's a little area called Lycaonia. It's famous for causing trouble for the Persian kings. He said, plunder it. Well, then they can go house to house, farmstead to farmstead, looting, raping, pillaging, behaving as they all want to behave in their wildest dreams as soldiers of fortune. What are they going to do with a bedstead? Well, there's a trader who's following the horde that's on the move, and he will pay money for that bedstead, take it away and sell it for a much higher price on the market somewhere else. Of course, the big trade was in slaves. You capture people, haul folks out of their beds, and carry them away. They are then sold to the slave traders, who are like vultures around the sides of all these conflicts, and they are then pushed into the international market of slavery. Since we're with these slaves, let's just spend one moment talking about slavery in the ancient world. It was different from slavery in American history. Slavery in American history was also tied to a caste system. Once you belong to the group of people who are identified as the slave caste, it's very hard to get out of it. It wasn't true in the ancient world. Slavery was regarded as a misfortune. It could happen to anybody. It could happen because you fell into debt. It could happen because you were a prisoner of war. It could happen just because your parents were slaves. But all slaves had the hope that they could earn their way out of that position. I mentioned when we talked about the Greek galleys that we have the image, partly from Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston chained to his oar, that those galleys were powered by prisoners or slaves unwilling to be there. That's not true in this classical period that we're talking about. Most of the people pulling the oars in those hundreds and hundreds of triremes and other warships are free citizens or free agents who have come as resident aliens to a place like Athens and hired their services out and must be paid. It was a very good way to earn a living as a young man. So slaves were not as important in ancient warfare. It was part of the identity of a citizen to fight for the city. You don't want slaves co-opting that role. And so slaves were kept to the rear, as the helots of Sparta were typically kept to the rear, although they were taken along on the campaigns to serve their masters, carry the army's shields and spears and so on from one battlefield to the next, do the cooking, attend to the needs of the actual warriors. So slavery is, it's different from what we're used to, and freed slaves could often go on and become millionaires. We're going to stop now because it's too interesting a topic and too important a one to pretend that we can do any more justice to now. At any rate, Cyrus is now in the center of this vast mass of people. He's got to deal with supplying them with food. If his total numbers were something like 30,000, with 10 to 13,000 Greeks and the rest Asiatics, you've got to double that. That was the standard rule of thumb that ancient historians used for estimating how many people are on the move. Double the size of the fighting force, and you've got the actual numbers of people that are in the horde. So just picture possibly 60,000 people all squeezing along these narrow roads through these mountain passes. I come from a town in Indiana, New Albany, Indiana. We've only got 40,000 people in the whole town, and I can't picture us hiking from New Albany to the tip of Florida, which would be the kind of thing that they were bound on, even with all of our modern skills and logistical support and of easy availability of food. It would be a huge undertaking, and this is what Cyrus is attempting to do. And I think one of the lessons we get from the close, detailed story that Xenophon gives us of the March of the 10,000 is that we're very wrong to think of there being anything small-time or primitive about these ancient peoples. They had worked up a very sophisticated way of dealing with the world on a very complex, intricate, and successful level, and that's proved by the successful March of the 10,000 into Asia. By the way, what they were doing was what the Greeks called going up. The Greeks always said, if you start at Sardis and go to Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire on the Great Road, you are going up to Susa. And the Greek word for going up is anabasis. And so the book that Xenophon is going to write about this journey has as its name anabasis, going up. But they're also, as we're going to see in the next lecture, have to get home, and that will be the going down. Now, Cyrus, at this point, is luring them from place to place. He's continuing to lie to them about their true destination. He wants to hold off as long as possible, letting them know where they're going. They come down to the sea. By the way, I never explained. He got money from Cilicia, from the queen of the country, who he had obviously been secretly dealing with, who he must have told, once I am king, I will remember those who have aided me, and you will be enriched beyond your wildest dreams. So she, as an investment for the future, came down with the wealth of Cilicia and paid him the money he needed to provide his troops with their pay so they would keep going. They came down to the sea at the absolute northeast corner of the eastern Mediterranean, where Syria becomes the country that's on the coast. You're out of Asia Minor now, at a place called Issos. We're going to be coming back to Issos. That's the place where Alexander will face King Darius in a great battle in the last stage of our history of the Greeks and the Persians. But for now, Issos was just the last port that they would encounter before they turned away from the sea altogether. And there they found 700 more hoplite soldiers from Sparta sent out to Cyrus by the Spartan government. Although he was paying them like mercenaries, this was an official move on the part of the Spartans at home to say thank you for the support that Cyrus had given them that allowed them to destroy Athens and win that Peloponnesian War. He joined the 700 to his main body of troops. They marched on through the Syrian gates. This word gates, pile, is what the Greeks called passes, like Thermopylae in Greece. Hot gates, hot pass. And finally, at a place called Myriandros, they saw the Mediterranean for the last time and turned inland. He still hadn't fully leveled with them. He was still claiming they were just going to pass a little further into Syria and find there a Persian army that they were going to help him destroy. So they kept marching, lured onward by these tales that it's just the next stage, it's just over the next mountain range, that's the limit of our intention. And always goaded onward by the promise of more money. But they finally settled down and said, once they got over the mountains, we want a promise here. You're going to have to promise to pay every man 5 minae of silver when this is all over, or we're not going any further. We want a pledge from you, Cyrus. 5 minae of silver, that was years' worth of pay. And he had to agree. They had him where they wanted him. At all costs, he had to keep that army moving. 12 days from the coast, 12 days from the Mediterranean, they came to that fabled river, the Euphrates. And now they were approaching Mesopotamia, which is the land between the rivers, the two rivers being the Euphrates on the west, the Tigris on the east, and those great cities of antiquity, Nineveh and Babylon, were located on or between these two rivers. So now they had to go south, but first they wanted to cross the Euphrates. And they were at a place called Thapsacus or Zeugma. Zeugma is the Greek word for pontoon, where there used to be a pontoon bridge. And Cyrus had taken them there, hoping to get them across the bridge. The Persian who was ahead of him, this Persian general who was retreating in front of him, the man loyal to Artaxerxes, he had burned the bridge, burned the boats, which were the pontoons for carrying the bridge. How were they going to get across? The whole thing might have been derailed there, because they had to cross the Euphrates, and there weren't many places to get an army across. But by what they considered a miracle, that river, which should have been full and brimming with water coming down out of the mountains of Armenia, was lower than anyone had ever seen it at that time of the summer, and they were able to walk across the Euphrates and even get the draft animals and the carts across and get to the other side. It seemed truly that the gods were with this expedition. Once on the other side, they turned south. It had taken them 12 days to get to the Euphrates from the sea. Now they had 13 days through increasingly arid territory. Xenophon describes this as the desert of Arabia. And although that's very far north of where we draw the limit of Arabia today, clearly the Greeks realized that the sandy wastes that they were looking at to their right stretched all the way down through the Arabian Peninsula to the place in Yemen where they got their frankincense, and that they were looking at an ocean of sand, an ocean of aridity filled with strange animals that they could see as they marched along, ostriches and bustards among the birds, antelopes, gazelles, wild asses, roaming in herds among the shrubs that grew on that plain because there wasn't enough water for trees. If Cyrus had not, through his careful planning, had with them enough supplies to get through this 13 days of what amounted to a desert trek, they never would have made it. They owed it all to his foresight that they had their supplies with them, with this huge baggage train, and could go on. At last they saw looming up ahead of them a gigantic wall. It was called the Wall of Media. And it had been built between the Euphrates and the Tigris to serve as a defense against people coming out of the north exactly as they were doing now. It was 100 feet high and 20 feet thick. It was made of mud brick that had been cemented together with bitumen, which they took from the petroleum seeps, which came up in various places in the Near East at that time and which they had no further use for than as a building material to cement mud brick together or as pitch to make the ships proof against shipworm. They passed by the wall. They had expected to find it held against them. It was not. That Persian general was so terrified of the size of Prince Cyrus's army that he was simply fleeing southward to try to join Artaxerxes. They kept on moving down. They came to a great canal that connected the Tigris and Euphrates. They got across it, and then to a trench, which Xenophon was under the impression had just been dug to try to stop them. We're not sure that that's true, but at any rate, one more barrier to cross. At this point, they left the baggage train behind. Cyrus began to feel that the moment of crisis was at hand. And sure enough, 2 days after leaving the baggage train, as they were walking along at their ease, confident, since the landscape was so eerily empty, that Artaxerxes, terrified by their numbers, had decided not to confront them, one of the scouts who had been sent on ahead, a Persian noble, was suddenly seen coming up over the horizon at the gallop, and as he approached, he shouted to Cyrus, "Artaxerxes, is coming, he has an army with him. And when the scout was questioned, it turned out Artaxerxes' army was even larger than their own. So we have brought Xenophon and his 10,000 into the heart of the Persian Empire, and there we must leave them till next time.